This episode of The Overlook is presented by Sunlight Tax, financial advice and tax planning tailored for creatives. Learn more at sunlighttax.com. It's been 7 weeks since the crippling failures in Asheville's city water system.
News 13 continues to ask questions about Asheville's recent water crisis, including why a local disaster declaration was not made.
For every question city officials have answered about what happened over the holiday calamity, another hangs in the air, unanswered, at least for now. I'm Matt Pikin, and this is the debut episode of The Overlook, a podcast devoted to the news, arts, issues, and trends of Asheville. My guest today is the Dean of Local Journalism, reporter and columnist John Boyle. He recently left the Citizen Times newspaper after 27 years to join the investigative online outlet AVL Watchdog. Nobody has covered what happened with the city's water system with the depth and consistency that John Boyle has.
They didn't recognize how it was going south so quickly. I think part of it, too, was they did not have a good handle on exactly what was the problem.
We talk about the checkered history of the city's water system, how the city handled communications with the public in the latest system failure, and the road ahead for the committee tasked with looking backward and forward. We'll get to my conversation in just a moment, but I first want to introduce you to Hannah Cole. She's an Asheville artist who makes beautiful paintings. She's also an accountant who started Sunlight Tax in large part to help creatives like her. And as we approach tax time, Hannah is urging creatives and other freelancers to deduct their home offices on their upcoming returns.
You have to understand how the rules work, but it's such a big deduction. It's so juicy. And I think a lot of accountants scare their clients about it because people have this impression that you're going to be audited if you take it, which is not really true.
Hannah, is the home office deduction only open to homeowners, or can renters also take advantage of it?
You're eligible either way. So renters can absolutely take this deduction.
Hannah produces a lot of videos, a podcast, a blog, a visual guide to deductions, all free of charge as community financial resources. She also has a more comprehensive money boot camp. Find out more about all of it at sunlighttax.com. I started off my conversation with John Boyle asking whether the city of Asheville had dealt with infrastructure crises like this before.
Certainly with water. I mean, I've been here. I was at the paper for 27 years. I've been Asheville Watchdog since then. And constant problems with pipes breaking. They've had multiple initiatives to fix pipes. You know, going back, they had a lot of these clay pipes. I think they've probably gotten rid of most of those. They would break all the time. I mean, they were 100 years old and they would break all the time. And they kind of ignored that in the 20th century for a long time. You know, I wrote about how they had all this debt from the Great Depression. And Asheville's one of the few cities that actually didn't declare bankruptcy and paid their debt off. But it stymied them on doing a lot of development in infrastructure for decades. So, you know, coming into the latter part of the 20th century, they had this really old system that had been neglected, and it would just constantly break all the time. You know, one thing that was fascinating to me, and Sally Keston gathered this data, they had boil water advisories are usually indicative of a pipe breaking or a leak or sedimentation or some kind of problem. And they had over 720 of them between 2017 and 2021. And part of that is they changed their criteria. Now they issue more of like a warning to folks that, hey, your water could potentially go out. So they changed the methodology of it some. But even that, I mean, it indicates 720 in 4 years. You get a lot of problems going on in your system. In 2019, the city had a very colorful problem with water in that it had excessive manganese in the pipes, which is a naturally occurring mineral. And it's in food and stuff, and a little bit of it is fine for you. Your bodies need manganese, but it turned the water brown. That was another thing. It took a while for them to come out with what the problem was and communicate this well. And one of the things they were telling people was that the water is safe. Well, who the hell wants to drink brown water? I mean, no one's going to drink brown or wash their clothes in it. And everything's going to turn brown. To me, that was on a very, very small scale of the communications issue that you have, you know, and like telling people, yeah, go ahead, drink the water. It's fine.
From your vantage point, since this has been talked about for decades that this is a problem, and you just mentioned the statistic, which is pretty alarming, is it just a matter of cost that the city knows that really fixing this is going to be an enormous undertaking, or is there something more going on? Is it just the commitment to this kind of work and the long-term nature of what this would take?
I think there's a commitment there to address it from the city. And Esther Mannheimer, the mayor, mentioned this a couple times. They have allocated $10 million to $11 million a year. I had a chart in the story about, you know, at least $10.3 million every year the last 5 years towards upgrades, replacing pipes, fixing valves, that kind of thing. But, you know, you could argue, well, it needs to be a whole lot more, clearly. I feel like they know they need to address it. They've got more serious about it in the last 20 years. But Charles Worley, the former mayor, I thought had a really good point in the latest story that I did where he said, you know, you can never spend enough on infrastructure in a city. You just can't. I mean, you know, you could replace the entire system. One story that I found, an old story from the 90s, the water director at the time said, you know, same problem, you know, same breaks going on, that kind of thing. And he said at the time it would cost $300 million to redo the whole system, which, you know, in today's dollars, I don't know, probably be $400 million, you know. So, yeah, so it's kind of pie in the sky to fix everything. And I do think they've made a commitment to upgrade and keep with things. But I kind of feel like they're going to go back and address, hey, do we need to be spending more to prevent this kind of thing from happening again?
So let's go back to the immediate aftermath of the holidays and when people are gathering their feet about them. And here's the problem. There's two strands. There's the actual problem and then the communication issue. Why was there a communication problem?
I think it was probably, I hate to use a cliche of perfect storm, but my dealings, and it seemed like what was going on was, it was a holiday weekend. So you had a lot of people in town, increased water usage, unusual cold snap. And then I got to think there were some key players that were not here. You know, that, I mean, it was Christmas Day, things start going south. They probably come back in Monday, Tuesday. I know some of them told me they worked 12 days straight. I think they didn't get on top of a couple things. They didn't recognize soon enough that it was a crisis, an emergency. And Esther Mannheimer said that. And then they did not communicate quickly enough. They didn't hold their first press conference till 3 days after Christmas, I believe. You know, and Esther Mannheimer acknowledged that was a mistake too. So I think they didn't recognize how it was going south so quickly. And then I think part of it, too, was they did not have a good handle on exactly what was the problem. In the latest story I did, you know, the David Melton, the water director, initially said they had 11 or 12 city pipes break. And you heard that at press conference, too.
Yes.
And then when the timeline comes out, it's 27. That's a big difference. I mean, to me, that is an indicative of an infrastructure issue. And then he had said it was the intakes that froze on the plant at Mills River. Well, it was actually something else. It was a more technical kind of problem, but it wasn't quite what he had said. So I think there was a lot of things happening very quickly. They were probably a little bit, as far as communications, maybe a little understaffed, didn't get a good grasp on it and get the messaging out the door consistently. And one thing I know that drove people nuts that were, and like I say, I was not without my water. I couldn't swim at the YMCA down south. It was my only inconvenience. But, you know, they kept putting out these 12 to 24 hours or 24 to 48 hours, you'll have your water back. And they clearly didn't know. I mean, people were not getting their water back that quickly.
Why do you think they were putting out these optimistic timelines when they clearly didn't have a handle on what was really wrong?
I kind of feel like they thought that was going to be right. I didn't get the impression they were intentionally misleading people.
Do you think they honestly didn't understand the scope of the problem?
That's the impression I got. Anytime you have these kind of situations, weird stuff pops up or things go south that you weren't expecting. Case in point, you know, to get the water restored back to the western part of the county, they needed to pump it. And so they start pumping water, and they realize the pump they have is not adequate at all. And you can say they should have prepared better, or they should have had a scenario where they would know they'd need a bigger pump. But they had to go to Charlotte to a company that leases pumps and get a much more powerful pump to actually get the water over there. So I think, you know, the water didn't recharge in the system as quickly as they thought. They thought, okay, our pump will do it. So I don't get the feeling the communications folks were trying to mislead anybody. I think they were trying to give, I don't know if you say hope or just like, you know, if you say, well, it may never be back on, you know, you got to say something. And I think they were trying to give their best estimate at the time, but it was not a good estimate.
One of the things that struck me at the one press conference I was at, and I was wondering if you had this takeaway too, they seemed very reluctant to pinpoint how many people were being affected and exactly where they were being affected.
That was really frustrating for me as a journalist, I'm sure you too. That's a basic fact, you know, how many folks are without water? And they had said 1,385,000 customers, and then they backtracked on that and said, we really don't know. And then they couldn't get a good map out. We heard a lot of complaints about the map being useless. And you know, I think part of that was, I think Esther told me at one point, the staffers that would do those kind of graphics, they were on vacation and they came back, but it took them a couple days to get it together. One interesting thing I found in this story, I went back and kind of looked at history of outages and problems in the water system, which, like we mentioned, been going on for decades. And there was another outage in the 90s, I want to say 97, but that might not be right. But the water director at the time said he wasn't sure how many customers were affected. So, I mean, they've had the same problem for almost 30 years now, you know, 25 years. And part of that is their equipment, their monitoring, their real-time monitoring capability, which I think that's one thing that'll come out of this, is they're going to try to improve that, where Esther had talked about we need what the power company has, where power goes out, you get a flashing light, it's out, you get a notification or a text message, your neighborhood is experiencing an outage, power should be restored in whatever time frame. They want to get that, but it takes a lot of doing to get there.
It's interesting that, you know, we're in this era, I don't know if you've heard of this thing called the Internet of Things.
Right.
The IoT. And this is a smart technology where you can have that kind of pinpoint accuracy of who's getting what and who isn't. And I think we're in an era, maybe this is, we've been spoiled as a society that we expect more of a specific, oh, if we're getting an alert, it should be affecting me.
Right.
Right. Do you think some of what is happening or what some of the public fallout of what's happened is from high expectations of what the city capabilities should be?
I'm sure it is. And I could see that, you know, if my water goes out, I want to know immediately too. And you do. We're an instant gratification society. So yeah, it's got to be frustrating. But on the flip side of that, I think the city can do better. And that's the impression I got from the mayor, that they have this technology, they have a program they're working, but it's going to take like 20 months to get the technology in place. That kind of goes back to what we were talking about before too, of spending the money on it, you know, because that stuff's not cheap. And on a kind of in a twisted way, this will be good if and when city council says, hey, we need to dedicate another $2 million per year to the water system for this. People won't moan and groan about it. They'll say, okay, yeah, if it's going to result in better alerts. I'm totally throwing the $2 million figure out there. I don't know.
Well, but you're talking about both, we're talking about improving our piping system, modernizing that. We're talking about updating our alert system. All of this is money. And our taxes are already regarded as pretty high.
Right.
Where can the money for these kinds of improvements come from?
That's a really interesting aspect of all this, too. And another one that the history was intriguing to me, that I'm pretty sure is that same article from the 90s. The water director at the time said, well, you can only charge people so much because they'll rebel, you know, and you can only do so many improvements because you can only charge so much. Esther Mannheimer said the exact same thing. David Melton said the exact same thing. Charlie Worley said the same thing, former mayor. And clearly, I mean, that's where the money comes from. This is a self-funded fund. The water bills and the customers pay for all of these things, you know. So it's not like your property taxes aren't going to the water bill. Your water bill is paying for all of this
stuff. Water bill has gone up incredibly before this happened.
Yeah.
It's gone up like about 30% in the past 2 years.
Right.
Where is this money going if not for infrastructure improvements?
That'd be a good follow story. Where all does that money go? What are they using it for specifically? I would suspect some of it is going for these line replacements, improvements. I would imagine too, and this is me just speculating on this, but you know, everything has gone up in price, so I'm sure for them to make line replacements now is probably more expensive than it was 2 years ago. But that's a really good point. And it's also kind of interesting that you bring that up as a water customer, because how much are you willing to pay? You know, that's what it comes down to. And you got to, I think another thing maybe that'll come out of this, in the past, they've done multiple bond issues over the time. They did one in the 90s, around 2014, they did another one. You know, they have periodically launched bonds to help pay for this, because you can only do so much with people's bills, then you need to have a special program. We need $25 million for bing, bang, boom, you know. So that's another thing I suspect they will look at to prevent this from happening. Because, you know, we should say, too, yeah, it was unusually cold. It was there were 3 days in a row where it was well below average. I checked with the National Weather Service. But one thing that was mildly irritating to me was several of these officials made this sound like it was unprecedented. They were throwing that word around, and it's just not. I mean, we had a polar vortex dip down in 2014. We've had multiple times of single-digit temperatures. In the last story, it was 33 times of single-digit temperatures since 1999. So we're not prone to severe cold weather routinely in the mountains in winter, but it's certainly not unheard of.
In my mind, when I'm envisioning the amount of work it would take to replace the pipes to fully modernize, this seems like such a tremendously expensive undertaking. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess it's anybody's guess whether we, you know, to answer your question with an open question, who knows what we're willing to pay?
Of these 27 lines that broke, most of them are cast iron. So the progression of pipes and cities, I mean, literally, they used to use wood, logs hollowed out and carried water. And they worked well for years and years, and then they would rot, and they'd have to replace them. Then they went to clay or terracotta, which was better, but, you know, it's clay, so it breaks. Then they went to iron, cast iron, which is very, very strong, but it's also very brittle. Especially as it gets older, it can shatter, break much easier. So then they went to ductile, it's called ductile iron, which has some more flexibility built into it. And then now there's different kinds. There's more like these polymers and PVCs and stuff you see at Lowe's, you know, but on a bigger scale. And those are better.
Is that the contemporary piping now?
Yeah, and my impression, and this is from talking to a couple engineers, is they'll still use ductile iron in places, but they try to avoid cast iron anymore. Mm. And I think this one engineer I talked to, and he mentioned a specific type, it's, you know, some kind of polymer sort of thing that is along the lines of these PVCs that are considered the best now. So yeah, you know, they've got cast iron that's 50 years old that was slated to last even longer than that, and should they go in and replace all of that? So
would this mean replacing it at the street level, like individual streets? At what level are we talking about coming out of the water treatment plants, and how far out are we talking about replacing these pipes?
Yeah, that's one interesting thing we're trying to get in more detail, is specifics on where the lines broke and what parts of the lines. Was it at valves? Was it at depth? They told me these lines are buried 4.5 feet, which is plenty deep for our frost line. In this area, the frost line is typically 18 inches. So some of that they won't release because of security concerns, homeland security. Yeah, which I sort of get that, but I mean, you can't say we're not going to show you any maps of any water lines because someone might go sabotage them. I mean, people can figure this stuff out. I mean, like, they wouldn't even say where the, they kept calling the Mills River water plant the South Asheville plant.
Oh.
That was another thing in the communications that was frustrating for folks, because people were like, where the hell is the South Asheville water plant? It's in Henderson County. It's on the Mills River in Henderson County, about a half mile from the Mills River plant that the city of Hendersonville uses, which, by the way, they had one line break and no water outages for any period of time, you know, system that is a half mile as the crow flies along the river didn't freeze.
Hannah Cole is an Asheville artist and accountant and the founder of Sunlight Tax. She has all kinds of free resources on her website, including a podcast called Sunlight. Hannah serves up practical advice in short episodes about taxes and shaping how people in creative fields think about business.
It is about tax and money issues for, I like to say, visionary creators. So people who are doing care work, healing work, and creative work. People who are driven by a passion and not just for money. To me, people doing that creative work are changing the world for the better. We're the empathy muscle of our culture.
Sunlight ranks in the upper tier of entrepreneurship podcasts on the iTunes chart. Go to your favorite podcast outlet and find Sunlight with Hannah Cole, and go to sunlighttax.com for all the other resources Hannah offers, including details on her money bootcamp. John Boyle began the next part of our conversation with a fact I found rather stunning.
So the city of Asheville has always been plagued by water loss. Every water system in America loses water through leaks. You cannot make a perfect system. It's going to leak in different places. EPA, I believe their standard, or they said on average most systems leak about 14%. Asheville's is 27%, and it has been for almost all the time I've been here. And we had stories at the newspaper in the 90s that said their leak percentage was around 30%, certainly over 25%. They had a campaign about 10 years ago to bring that down. There's a chart in the story I did. It kind of goes like a looping curve, but not real big, kind of goes down for a few years and comes back up. And it right now it's back where it was. It's at 27%.
You said kind of the average, or it's acceptable to lose about 14%. We're talking about more than double that.
Right.
What is the cause of that? Is that also simply that we have aging or aged pipes? Or is there something more going on here?
From reporting on that in the past, the aging pipes are a big problem. My understanding too is it's issues with valves. They can, you know, be problematic or leaky too, but it's an infrastructure problem. I mean, you've got leaks. You know, there was a really fascinating issue back in the 90s. A former long ago mayor, a guy named Dick Wood, back in the 70s, he talked about how, yeah, it was that high and, you know, coming out of North Fork, we knew we were losing 30% of the water. But it would cost more to go and fix it than it was worth because they basically were getting and delivering water fairly cheap. It was a lot of wasted water, but it wasn't an exorbitant cost as far as running the system goes. So I think that's kind of been the attitude for a long time, is that, you know, it's more expensive to go in here and redo all the infrastructure.
You would think if we're losing that much, you know, up in the upper 20s to 30%, in the winter, that could freeze and also cause some of the problems, you know, with cracking and other...
Yeah, that's a really interesting aspect to it. And somebody asked me, follow-up, we always get really good questions from readers, you know, and a lot of very smart people out there that engineering backgrounds or just fascinating backgrounds. And someone was asking, you know, where does all that water go that's leaked? And I would assume, you know, water, the old cliche about it, follows the path of least resistance. So it is, but you do wonder if that in places undermines pipes and the shoring up of them, and that can cause problems with support and sagging, or, you know, I don't know. It seems astronomical to allow a system to leak that much water. Plus, you know, you got to filter it to get all the stuff out of it. You need to treat it for microbes and all that kind of thing and purify it so it's safe to drink. So this 27% of water, it's gone through all these steps, you know? I mean, it's got chemicals in it, fluoride and chlorine and all that good stuff, and it's just going in the ground.
So we're losing it after it's been through the filtration.
Yeah, after it's coming out of the plant. Yeah, as far as we know, the reservoir is pretty watertight. That's, you know, but it's in this system. And to be fair to Asheville, they have 1,700 miles of water lines to keep track of.
Which is why I was getting to the expense issue. If we got 1,700 miles of lines, can you imagine the cost in replacing and modernizing that?
Yeah, and you know, I haven't heard them give an estimate, and I'm going to ask them this on what, because if it's, like I said, if it's $300 million in the 90s, I can only assume.
It's going to be double.
At least. I mean, I would think it would just be, I imagine it would be, and not all of it needs to be replaced, you know, but it'd be interesting for them to identify, we need to replace this many miles of our system. It will cost $500 million bucks, and you know, it's probably too large of a bite to take at one time.
I know we have a commission that has been formed to get to the bottom of what happened and make recommendations, but how much do we know about what exactly happened and what don't we know yet?
From what I have gathered, they have a better handle on what happened. The lines where they broke, more precisely what happened at Mills River when it froze, what was going on when they went to recharge the system, that pumping issue that we talked about. So I feel like they have a better handle on it. But my hope is this commission would get into the old classic of, you know, who knew what when and who made what decision when. You know, one of the key components is David Melton, the water director, with input from his staff, made the decision to cut off water to South Buncombe County, South Asheville, Buncombe County. The thinking was that if they released the water from North Fork, which is north of the city and very, much more elevated, comes in at a really high pressure, it could cause damage to pumps and lines in the south if they just were to open that valve. Melton said the term sacrifice he thinks is accurate. Ben Woody, assistant city manager, and his boss said that's probably a little strong, but they had to make a decision to cut that off.
Right. It was a judgment call.
Right. It was. And Melton said he would make the same decision again.
Interesting.
He said if they had not done it that way, then they would have to issue boil water advisories to the entire system, which would include downtown, Mission Hospital, all these medical offices. So it would, yeah, it would create a lot of hardship on the most heavily populated area. An engineer that we talked to named John Rains, he and the other engineer that I talked to, they both were adamant that it should be a professional engineer, a PE, a licensed engineer, running that department. David Melton is a business major from Anderson University in South Carolina, kind of came up through the business side of things. They do have, he said they have three PEs on staff, but they were adamant that, you know, water systems are pretty much all engineering. They said most sizable systems have a professional engineer running the show.
Does this show itself that having somebody who's not a professional engineer running that department is itself a problem?
These two engineers thought so. I can see the very strong point that an engineer would have a better grasp of the engineering aspects of all of this. And I suspect this is something that committee needs to look at and the city needs to look at. And that's one of the things I mentioned about this committee. You know, what are they going to look at? Were there incorrect decisions made that could have been better made if an engineer was running the department?
Let's talk about this commission. As a citizen of Asheville, I can only speak for myself, I would be fine myself not being on this committee and having just professionals who deal with water infrastructure and engineering be on this committee. And I understand running alongside that was the communications problem. Mm-hmm. And figuring out people who also have a technical background in communications, what we could do to modernize our alert system, and perhaps have some people who are professionals at a high level of crisis communications, of best practices. Why do we need anybody from the community sitting on this committee, which to me might only gum up the works?
It could, but I can see where they'd also at least have some valuable input on, hey, I didn't get a notification until 3 days later, and I didn't know you had to sign up for AVL alerts to get them, you know. I think you will find some valuable input that you otherwise wouldn't from what it's like to be on the receiving end. Yeah, I think in a way, you know, you can never make a perfect committee and these kind of things, and they're, I just bet everything's going to be somewhat political, you know. But I believe they have three engineers on there. One of them is a former water director in Asheville, which is good and bad. He'll have familiarity with the system, but you could consider maybe he'll kind of be protective or, to a degree. They brought in another person, I think, from Knoxville or out of state, hopefully would be objective. And then they brought in some communications professionals to get at that angle of it, and then community members to look at the angle of impact on people. Yeah, I think it could probably use a little more non-biased technical input. My main concern with that is if human beings made mistakes, which is entirely possible because we all do, I feel like there'll be a reluctance to name names in that, you know, so-and-so never should have done this. So-and-so was supposed to have ordered this bigger pump. You know, I just kind of worry there'll be some CYA, as I wrote in a column, you know,
yes,
cover your rear end on this and not want to call folks out if human beings made mistakes in the situation.
Good thing I have my trusty notebook, and good thing I have my dear old thing.
I want to thank John Boyle as the guest for my debut episode of The Overlook. Huge thanks to Leela Mann for her unrivaled help in getting this show off the ground, and to Sunlight Tax for presenting this episode as our first sponsor. Our theme song is Maker's Song, provided courtesy of the Asheville band The Resonant Rogues. Susan and Giles Collard of Asheville Contemporary Dance Theater are allowing me to use the BB Theater to record some of my interviews until my own space is up and running. The Overlook is a production of Podcast Asheville. New episodes are online 6 a.m. every Monday through Friday. Please follow for free on your favorite podcasting app. I'm Matt Pikin, and I'll see you on the next episode of The Overlook.